You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
The end of John chapter 4, begin in verse 45. When Jesus arrived in Galilee, the Galileans welcomed him. They had seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the Passover festival, for they had also been there. So this group had seen all of these different miracles that he had performed. Once more, Jesus visited Cana. That's where he turned the water into wine. And when he's at Cana, there was a certain royal official whose son lay sick at Capernaum. When this man heard that Jesus of Nazareth had arrived in Galilee from Judea, he had traveled up near to Capernaum, the royal official said, "I'm going to go travel to Jesus." And he begged Jesus to come down and heal his son who was close to death. The word he later uses is spaideon, which refers to a boy beneath puberty, little kid. And the intensity that you feel as a parent to have a child that you're afraid is going to die, would have died. I haven't been there. I've had a couple of close calls. Man. Allergic reaction, throat, face, everything started to swell. He looked like he was going to die. Put him in the car during rush hour. I was weaving between cars. I mean, going on the, you know, that psycho you see on the rail that you're not supposed to, that was me. And in the meantime, he's in the back seat. I was holding his hand because he was, you know, having a shock. He couldn't breathe, just trying to keep him calm. I got to the ER. Talking to the nurse behind there, he's being all, "Oh, how are you doing today? How's everyone doing?" I was just like, "We need to get him back there right now. He can't breathe. Shut up." And the guy's like, okay. So the crash cart and everything. Oh, man. Talk to my son later. He's like, "I thought I was going to die." And I was just like, no. Meanwhile, I'm like, oh, man, I did too, buddy. You know what I mean? I mean, I don't know. You just don't know, but the fear, the abject fear that you have to have a kid, you know, everything about this kid, you love this kid, close to death. So it's no wonder that he travels all the way from Capernaum to Cana. That would have been roughly a 20-mile trip. And we learn later that he walked. So he walks all the way from Capernaum to Cana to meet this miracle worker whom he had heard about. Well, Jesus, being the sensitive man that he is, as he encounters this man, he told him, "Unless you people see signs and wonders, you will not believe." Where's the bedside manner on this one, Jesus? This dad, he travels 20 miles to come and see you, and he just says, "Oh, you just want to see another miracle." Well, that word "believe" there, "you'll never believe," let's start with that. That's really at the crux of this entire pericope, this chapter. What does it mean to believe? What does it mean to believe or to have faith? That word faith. Culturally, I mean, if we were to take a definitional use in our culture, you would say that it's contrary to reason. Even when you use that word faith, usually you associate it with blind faith. Or that faith is contrary to knowledge. Some people will say, "Well, I believe that, but I don't know that." Okay, according to a Christian worldview, that is like a married bachelor. That's like a triangle with four sides. That makes no sense. How can you believe something that you don't know? The Christian worldview is a knowledge worldview. You believe in things that you know. What about contrary to caution? You just take I hate this expression. Oh, do I hate it? I hate it almost as much as people who use it. A leap of faith. Oh, you just need to take a leap of faith. It just makes it sound like you just jump and you just kind of hope something's going to catch you. Contrary to caution, no. I don't want people just going out and doing things that are absurd, that you could just die, something like that, because you were hasty. That's not biblical faith. Paul, when people were coming to come after him, he would escape. He would leave. He would, in Acts chapter 9, at the end of the chapter, his disciples lowered him down in a basket. He called in the authorities later when he visited Jerusalem. I mean, not contrary to caution, no. Contrary to exploration. Some people, when they say faith, you say, why do you believe that? They say, well, because my mom believes that. Oh, so you were raised that way. Yeah. So if you were raised in another culture at another time, in another place with different parents, you believe what they believe. Yeah. Now, I'm not here to say that we aren't influenced by our parents or anyone else. What I'm saying is that is a completely inadequate justification for your faith. So if you grew up in Aristotelian times, you'd believe that the earth is the center of the universe. Well, yeah, you probably would believe that, and it would be wrong what you believe. So your parents are Muslim. So you're a Muslim. That's the reason you believe it, because you were born that way. Your parents went to church. You're a Christian. That's why you believe it. I hope you can see that is such a superficial approach to your faith. Please. Yeah, I believe a lot of the things my mom told me, but I also went on to investigate those things. Didn't you? All right, let's do a little survey. How many people here believe everything that their mom believes? There's always one. All right, how many people here love their mom? Okay, see, you can love your mom without believing everything that she believes. And the same is true here. I was raised to believe something. That doesn't mean that I believe everything they believe. All right, here's a little clip I brought you. This is Richard Dawkins, the arch-atheist skeptic, on his view of faith. See what you think.
What I'm talking about there is faith, where faith means belief in something without evidence. Because if you believe something without evidence, then that justifies anything. You're no longer vulnerable to somebody coming back at you and saying, hang on a minute, let me argue the case. If you believe it without evidence, which is what faith is, then you don't argue the case. You say, no, I'm not arguing that case. This is my faith. It's mine. It's private. I don't dissent from it. I don't retreat from it. You're just going to have to accept it. Now, that is evil.
I don't know. What do you think about that? I agree with that. I agree with every word he said. Yeah, that's true. He's describing a blind faith. Blind faith. He's talking about an irrational faith, something that isn't open to the realm of discourse and discussion. It's a discussion stopper. That's my faith. I don't know what else. The buck stops here. It's got to stop somewhere. It's a brute fact. I agree with everything he said. The problem is that's not the Bible's definition of faith. And Dawkins has been corrected on this innumerable times. Every Christian scholar out there has said the Bible doesn't teach that. There was a moment where one of his colleagues, Professor John Lennox, turned to Richard Dawkins and he said, belief and evidence aren't compatible with each other. He says, Richard, don't you believe that your wife loves you and don't you have evidence for that? And Dawkins said, oh yes, of course I have evidence for that. And all Lennox said was, And the crowd went wild and Lennox took a sip of his water like a boss. It was awesome. No, of course we believe things in concert with evidence. Of course you do. More importantly, the biblical definition of this word, pistis, that's the noun form, pistis, faith, or pistuo, believe. To believe is the verbal form. What does the word faith mean? Not according to our 21st century American culture in English, but 20 centuries in the past in a different culture. What do the Greek lexicons and scholars say what the word meant in that time? Well, they say this. Number one definition, trust. Someone in whom confidence can be placed. Number two definition, believing on the basis of the reliability of the one trusted. Trust, confidence, that's what faith means. And trust is earned. You wouldn't just trust a stranger to watch your car. You know, hey, would you watch my car for a while? No, you wouldn't do that. You wouldn't have a stranger, you know, trust them if you didn't know them. Trust is earned. There's evidence behind why you would believe that. So I get pretty exercised about this because it seems like on every single talk show and everything, you know, when they bring in somebody who is going to speak about like a scientific issue, who do they get? They get an expert, you know, scientist. If they have, you know, someone talking about legal issues, who do they get? An expert, you know, lawyer, somebody like that. But then when they bring on somebody who is going to talk about faith, who do they get? Anybody. Anybody who can fog a mirror, anybody who can put two words together. And what does that show you? That they think that certain areas, certain domains of thinking are in the realm of knowledge, something on which you'd want to be an expert and study, and other areas are areas that are just areas of personal belief, private, subjective inklings and feelings. Well, I just don't buy it. It's not true, and it's not what the Bible teaches. Now, that being said, this doesn't mean that we need 100% certainty when we talk about faith. We just need good reasons. As philosophers put this, justified true belief. Justified true belief. We need good justification for what we believe. And really, people who say, well, I can't believe in God because why? Well, because, you know, it would just have to be something that's 100% certain. Really. Where else in your life do you have 100% certainty of anything? I'll tell you where. Apodictic certainty, apodictic truths, like 2 and 2 make 4. That is 100% certain because it's definitionally true. You know what I mean? A bachelor is an unmarried male, 100% certain. You get outside of that, it's who knows? I mean, we have levels of trust in our lives. You go into a restaurant, for example. You order a big, juicy cheeseburger. Where did that meat come from? How was it prepared? Who prepared it? When they prepared it, did you see them prepare it? Did you see them sit on the toilet for 20 minutes before they came out to make your burger? I hope not. That'd be perverted. But did you see them wash their hands? Did you see, maybe, did you test them for any diseases? What about the lettuce on top of your burger? That could have some kind of microbe on it, or maybe a fungus is growing inside the bun. I mean, you really don't know that, but when I get into Thurman's, I chow down. Why? Because I have good reasons to believe that that's going to be an exquisite night. I'm going to enjoy it, and it's going to be good for me. Now, am I 100% certain that that is true? No. I've gotten food poisoning, so have you. But I have good reasons to believe it. Same is true in every area of life. Well, I don't know if I marry this girl, if it's going to end in divorce. No, you don't know. You don't know that. Well, I don't know if I buy this used car, if it's not going to explode, you know, next week. You don't know that. Well, I don't know if I get into this, you know, program at school, if that's really going to work. You don't know that. So what's your solution? I'm not going to ever go to school. I'm not going to ever get a career. I'm going to walk everywhere I go, and I'm going to be single for the rest of my life. You could do that. You would avoid harm because you didn't get fooled. You didn't get tricked. You didn't suffer. But the consequences would actually be worse. You would be forfeiting a career, making money. You would be forfeiting the ability to drive places. God, I love to drive rather than walk. You would be forfeiting love relationships, friendships, girlfriend, boyfriend, marriage, maybe kids. I mean, your whole life would become very, very small if you had your skepticism meter cranked up to an 11. Now, let's take this one step further. What if we're talking about the greatest possible being that we could ever conceive of? And your skepticism meter is cranked up to an 11. Say, I don't know if I can really believe in God. I don't know about the afterlife. I don't know if heaven is really real. Okay, well, you got to explore that, right? You got to look into the evidence. However, I would say that if you're just going to a priori say, well, I can't be 100% sure, that is that you don't use that method in any other area of life except for the most important area, the afterlife, eternity, forgiveness, knowing God. Oh, that would be a catastrophic mistake and honestly, hypocritical, because you use this method in every other area of life except when it comes to the ultimate issues in life. Well, that's belief. Unless you people see signs and wonders, you will never believe. So it seems like Jesus is saying they shouldn't have signs and wonders. Is Jesus against miracles? Well, for a man who performs something like 40 to 50 miracles, in the four Gospels. I just can't believe that. Moreover, in the same book, chapter 20, verses 30 and 31, this is the culmination of John's Gospel. There's the climax in Thomas saying, I believe, my Lord and my God. And he says, blessed are you who believe. And then it says, Jesus performed many other signs, same word, in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these have been written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah and that you can have life in his name. Jesus performed these signs and these were given to us. Why? Precisely so that we could believe. That's why. So however we interpret this text, it can't be that Jesus is saying, I'm against giving you signs or evidence of some sort. What is the issue at stake? It's the miracles have a tremendous amount of deficiencies. Evidence and miracles are like a Venn diagram. They overlap, but they're not the same. You know, I've had many instances in my life which I would consider to be miracles, something I couldn't explain through the, you know, product of time and chance and matter and energy, natural processes. But I'll tell you this, I've forgotten about a lot of them. I actually had to sit down today, pull out a journal, and look through some of these, I'm talking about incredible answers to prayer, events that it's not just like a coincidence. It's that, you know, we were praying for something that it would happen. It was wildly implausible, and then it happens. Not just that it's improbable, it's that it's lining up with another factor, which is that you were praying for it, and boom, there it was. Weird things. Maybe after the teaching, if we hang out, I could tell you a few of them. If you get me a beer or two, we could talk. But for now, I'll just say, I've had these things happen. I remember one time, we were sitting out in the backyard, and we had the fire pit going, and we're hanging out, and I just asked the question. I was like, so who here has seen a miracle before? And I explained how you would know just a coincidence from a miracle. And one after another, people started sharing some of the most incredible stories you've ever heard. But it's almost like people had to be like, man, I can't, I think I've heard, oh yeah, that one time and that another time, and then and people were remembering them. Very easy to forget these kind of things. I don't wake up in the morning and think to myself, oh yeah, I remember that time in 2005, you know, that thing happened. And here's the other thing, they're addictive. When you get one miracle, you want another, and you want another, and you want another, and you want another. If your attitude is just to be spiritually stimulated, we see this in just a few chapters. In about a chapter and a half, Jesus feeds 5,000 men, and in addition to that, women and children. And then he goes out and he walks on water, he gets up on the shore, and then they say to him, what signs do you give us so that we should believe in you? That always cracks me up. Jesus is like, how about when I fed 5,000 men like a day ago? What about that? That doesn't count? Yeah, most people, when they have a miracle occur in their life, they're just thinking, well, when's the next one going to happen? That was cool, but what have you done for me lately? Miracles also lack content. They're not contentful. Like, if I spoke to you something, that'd be different than if I painted like a piece of art. Those are two different mediums through which I could communicate. Miracles are one medium that you could communicate. But if right now somebody was, you know, I don't want to get too macabre here, but somebody was shot in the head. I just did. All right, somebody got shot in the head and they landed on it, and then all of a sudden they just hopped up and everything came back together and they were perfectly fine. I would say that's what they call a miracle, right? Right? And I'm the only one? Give me an amen, please, somebody. A bunch of sphinxes are just staring at me. Somebody got shot in the head and popped right up after that. I would go, whoa, that was a miracle. What does it mean? Does it mean that God has a special plan for his life, for her life? Does it mean that God is with us here in this room? Does it mean this is a holy place? Does it mean, what does it mean? I don't know. I know that it means that God's there, but I don't know how to interpret it. In fact, very frequently when God performs a miracle, people have the wrong interpretation. They see, oh, he did that, so that must mean, and you talk to people about this, they've had genuine experiences, and you're like, what did you take from that? And they're like, well, I took from it that, you know, I should eat less carbohydrates or something. You're like, what? How did you come to that conclusion? We need content. So with the signs of Jesus, we see that he does miracles, and then he does explanations to explain what that meant. Miracles can often be denied as well. Many different interpretations, you know. Even in John 12, there's an experience where Jesus is praying openly, publicly. He's praying to the Father, and all of a sudden, God the Father speaks audibly to Jesus. And half the people say it was an angel, and half the people say it was thunder. So you had your supernaturalists, and you had your naturalists. It's like in Pulp Fiction, where John Travolta and Samuel Jackson, they go in to waste that one guy at the beginning. Remember, Samuel Jackson makes up that Bible verse from Ezekiel, and the wrath will be upon you, and they blow him away and stuff. Anyways, they kick open the door. Another guy has like a gun, and he goes, bang, 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 click, 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 click. And Travolta and Samuel Jackson are like, boom, they blow him away. For the rest of the movie, Samuel Jackson is like, dude, that was a miracle. He was point blank in front of us. He shot 12 times. We're alive. Travolta, by contrast, says, no, it was just chance. Samuel Jackson, miracle. Travolta, chance. The same event happened. They're both looking at the same thing. Who's to say which is which? Often denied, often misinterpreted. And frankly, God is not our court jester. See, Jesus is talking to the man, but really he's taking a bank shot off the man, speaking to the entire group. The verb here is plural, you people. The NIV has it right. You people see signs and wonders you'll never believe. Why is he so hard on these people? He's in Cana. Cana, where he turned the water into wine and performed other miracles. So, what does that mean? That means that Jesus is saying, I'm not here to be an entertainment trick for you. And this is his sign to communicate, not just to this man, but to the group. That's not who I am. You know what a court jester is, right? Back in olden times, you know, the king wanted to be entertained and he couldn't turn on the TV or whatever. So he'd be like, bring me the court jester. And this, you know, guy would come in and he'd dance around and do backflips and juggle stuff. And then he'd be like, all right, you're dismissed. And the court jester would be like, yes, sire, and he'd leave. And then when the king got bored, he would do it again. Bring in the jester, and he'd flip around and dance around. That's funny. Get out of here. You're dismissed. And this is essentially what we're seeing when we turn to God and we say, God, appear. God, now, I want you to do something now. Hey, I'm really struggling with my faith. I want you to appear to me right now. And God's just like, that's not how it works. I'm the king. You're the jester. Okay, that'd be closer to the illustration or the analogy than the other way around. The royal official, he is not dissuaded by this. He says, sir, come down before my child dies. Jesus replied, go, your son will live. What do you think was going through this man's mind at that moment? 20-mile trek back to Capernaum. Go. No, I told you to go. I'm the royal official here. He was second to Herod Antipas, the king. No, you are the one who's supposed to go. Like when I say go, people go, and you're telling me to go. Nobody tells me what to do. I'm the royal official. Do you know who I am? Now, I don't know. Maybe there are some people in this room who would resonate with that. The idea that when the Bible speaks to them, it's like, well, okay, maybe that's for other people, not for me. Maybe not. Maybe the guy was thinking, you know, I'm really hurting here. My son is on death's door, and you're telling me to go and take a step of faith? That's cruel. That's abusive. That's awful. I can't believe in the state that I'm in, you would have the audacity to tell me to go and just what, to start walking? Why is this the time that we're supposed to have steps of faith? You know, why can't you just answer a reasonable request? I'm making a reasonable request. It's a little boy, Jesus, and he's sick, and he's going to die. Can't you just heal him? Can't we just do it my way? I don't know what the man was thinking. I know I can resonate with all those thoughts, though, in my own life, where Jesus says, go. And I think to myself, well, that applies to other people, but not to me. Or he says, go, and I say, you know, I'm really hurting here. This is not the time to tell me to go out there and take a step of faith when I'm really banged up here. Or, you know, what am I'm suggesting here, is it that unreasonable? You can't go my way on this? Why won't you just answer the prayer? I'm asking again. Why won't you answer the prayer? And Jesus just says, go. The man took Jesus at his word. Oh, I wonder why he included it that way. Jesus spoke this word. He didn't give him a miracle. He didn't give him any kind of flash and dance or anything like that. He spoke a word, and the man said, I'm taking you at your word. And he departed. So it isn't just that he said, well, I take you at your word, now come with me. It's, he said, I take you at your word, and now I'm going to walk back to Capernaum. Ooh, that shows we're talking about a new level of faith right there. Not just saying, yeah, I kind of agree with that. Yeah, I believe that and stuff. Oh, yeah, Jesus' words, I believe those. I believe every one of Jesus' words, I believe those. To actually depart, to actually walk, to take a step, literally to take steps of faith, to walk in Jesus' words. Well, what was his experience, do you think, as he took that long voyage home? Did he have 100% certainty? He had just met Jesus right then. He didn't have 100% certainty. He had his word. He had a few words, not even that many. Go, your son will live. Do you think when he was walking for those 20 miles, he was just thinking to himself, wow, this feels great. Boy, I just love encountering Jesus. This is awesome. No. Come on. Be real. This is a real man. I bet the tears were streaming down his face. As he's walking back there, he's probably thinking to himself, did I screw up? Should I push harder? You know, I should have demanded it. I'm a royal official. What if I get back there and he's dead? But he said he'll live. I mean, I bet there was a true wrestling here. Do you think he enjoyed this trip home? Far from it. I bet this was a dark, dark night of the soul to be able to have the fortitude to take step after step all the way back to see if his son is even there. So what we're seeing here is that the man had his feelings, his emotions, his own perspective on things on the one hand, but then he had Jesus' word on the other. And the question for us is, which is weightier? Like, God could say something is true, but I don't feel like that's true. Who's right? Who's wrong? Well, while he was still on his way, his servants came out to meet him. That's not a good sign. He's probably thinking to himself, all right, they're already coming to meet me to tell me what happened to my son. Instead, what he finds out, the servants came to meet him with the news that the boy was alive. He had been healed. And when he inquired as to the exact time when his son got better, they said to him, yesterday it happened. When? At 1 p.m, the fever left him. Then the father realized this was the exact time at which Jesus had said, your son will live. So that whole waiting period of traveling, a full day of walking back to Capernaum, his son was safe the entire time. He could have stomped his feet. He could have wept and wailed. He could have thrown a temper tantrum. He could have attacked Jesus for all that would have been worth. And instead, Jesus had this entire thing providentially squared up. He's already healed. So what's with the theater of telling him, well, you go, your son will live, and making him walk back? It must have been for that man's benefit. that he learned something on that voyage, on that walk, taking step after step of faith to the point that he sees the boy, and then he correlates it. See, a boy losing a fever, that's improbable. He's on death's door, that's improbable. But when you correlate that with praying and talking to Jesus, and it happens at the exact moment, the exact hour, that's not a coincidence. They use this methodology in forensic science. They use it in all sorts of different scientific disciplines. It's called a specified improbability, and this man knew it. I mean, you don't have to be a modern scientist or philosopher or something. That's wildly improbable. He's about to die, and he was healed at the exact moment I talked to God about it. He and his whole family believed. So as a result of that long walk of faith, something changed in him that he believed, and it spread. He had a contagious sort of faith that had spread out to other people. This was the second semion, the second sign Jesus performed after coming from Judah to Galilee. So, what was his experience after he took this step of faith? Well, in verse 50, it says that he believed his word. He took him at his word. Verse 53, it says he believed Jesus. So, when did he believe Jesus? Verse 50, before he left, or verse 53, when he saw that this was fulfilled? Answer is both and. He started with a little bit of faith, enough just to walk. And then when he saw the fulfillment, oh, his faith must have just surged. And this is the way it is. When you take a step of faith and you start to move toward God, he puts something on your heart. You wrestle with him and you're like, no, I'm not saying no. I'm just saying not yet. No, I'm going to do it. I'm going to go for it. And you take that little step of faith. You don't feel good about it. You don't feel like, oh, this is so exciting. What happens is you take a step of faith and then God shows up. And then you get to the other side of that struggle and whoa, your eyes are opened. Your faith is built. And then all of a sudden another step comes up and you're like, definitely. Yeah, it's scary. Yeah, it's exciting. Yeah, it's an adventure. But your faith just gets built. It's like a muscle. The outcome was far better, too. He's saying, hey, I really want you to heal my son. From what? Physical death. Well, what would have happened to that man's son today? Would he be dead or alive today? Dead. He'd be dead. That was 2,000 years ago. He'd be dead. So is the man. So is everyone in this account, minus Jesus. He rose from the dead. But because Jesus worked in this man's life, he didn't just see his son come back from physical death. He saw his son and himself and everyone else come back from spiritual death. That now they will never be dead to God. They'll never be separated from God, like the prodigal son. You were dead and now you're alive. You were lost and now you're found. You're no longer alienated from me, but now you have new life. Oh, the outcome of this whole theater. Oh, it wasn't theater after all. Jesus had a whole idea orchestrated as an architect behind this to bring the entire family to faith. And his faith had an effect on other people. Yeah, the son, the whole family came to Christ. Remarkable. Well, as we conclude here, let's consider some questions. We've been studying about the subject of faith. I've asked a lot of people this question here. Why is it that you should believe in something? I remember when I was a brand new believer, my buddy asked me that. He's like, why do you believe in Jesus? And I was kind of like, then I kind of hemmed and awed, and I was like, well, it could be because I felt a certain way, and I experienced something. And he was like, well, I believe in him because it's true. And I was like, that's what I meant. That's what I meant to say. I meant to say because it's true. I knew that. Problem is, many people, they don't think about that when it comes to their faith. Why would you believe it? Here, just to take a little shot at our culture. Most people in our culture would say, you just believe because it's something personal. It's a leap of faith. It's blind faith. It's personal. It's private. It's objective. Okay. What would have happened if the man walked all the way back to Capernaum and his son was dead? That would be a false faith, right? Right? Yeah, Jesus saying, go, your son will live, and then he gets there and his son's dead. So to say, well, I'm going to believe in something, it doesn't really matter if it's true. I have no interest in that. I have no idea why you would have interest in something like that. You get all the way to the end of your life and you say, well, I believed in it. Why? Well, it made me feel good or whatever. It turns out it wasn't even real. What's the difference between you and a four-year-old who believes in Santa Claus? Makes them feel good, changes their behavior, I guess. Well, yeah, believing in it because it's true. Do you agree with this man's example of faith? Now, I know right away everyone knee-jerk is saying, yeah, oh yeah. No, you don't. Most people in this room, and I put myself in that group, most people in this room don't agree with this man's step of faith. You don't. We don't. I don't. Most people are not willing to take Jesus at his word. The path that we take is, well, I'll wait until it gets really bad. You know, I'll wait until somebody has to bring it up. I'll wait until it's just so noxious that, you know, it's ruining all my relationships. I'll wait until, you know, okay, wait a minute. You could spare yourself all of that. I don't know what the issue is in your life that comes to mind, but you do. And you know Jesus has something to say about that, and you're not willing to take him at his word. He speaks to this. Are you willing to depart? Are you willing to take steps of faith? This is very personal when you have an encounter with God on this. It's very interesting. When you have a change of heart and you say, yeah, I trust you. I think your way is the right way. I think I'm the one who's in the wrong. Very quickly, he'll be like, all right, take this one little step. Open up to that person. Read a book. Here's a good book on this. Share, you know. And all of a sudden, you take a little step of faith and you see the lights come right back on in your relationship. Your relationships start to flourish. Prayer becomes real again. You start to read things in the Bible and it's just like, whoa, I never saw that before. Because you're willing actually to put into practice what you've heard. See, we don't agree with this man. We want the feelings to come first. God wants a step of faith to come first. I want to feel really good about this, and then I do it. God's like, you'd never do it. If I gave you the feelings first, then you'd just be like, why would I do anything if I got the feelings? The feelings is all I want. No, God's like, actually, I want you to trust me more than your feelings and more than some kind of a carrot at the end of a stick that you get as a reward. I want you to trust me. And God is a giver. He wants you to have a great life. He wants you to be happy. Yeah, have good feelings. But this shouldn't precede it. It shouldn't antedate the step itself. Another way of thinking about this is, does every act of faith in your life need to be preceded by a sign or a strong feeling? Like before you act on what God says, you've got to have like some miracle. You know, you're driving down the road. Oh, if that light turns red, then I'll know. It means don't do it. You know, oh, if the sky is whatever, if the clouds make some kind of a shape, you know, or maybe it's just, you know, some kind of a feeling that you have. Every step of faith needs to be that way. If that's your view of following God, quit now. That is an unsustainable relationship. In fact, quit every relationship in your life. No relationship is that way, that you're just going to be feeling all the time for this person. No, it's as you move toward them in love that you start to feel the wholesome happiness that you get in relationships. I guess I would ask this. What is a step of faith that you have personally been reluctant to take, where you have been at odds with Christ? You know what he says. You know he says this, and you're like, no. If you're in that situation, take a step of faith. Do this. Once you do it, here's my prediction, okay? Here's my prediction. Once you do it, when you get to the other side of it, you're going to think to yourself, why didn't I do that earlier? Why did I procrastinate on this for so long? Oh, I was dragging my feet. It was actually making things worse the fighting and the thrashing and, oh, I don't want to do it. And then actually you take the step of faith and, oh, man, I wish I would have done that way, way earlier. Finally, for those of us here who are exploring their faith and their convictions about spiritual things, are you willing to explore the claims of Jesus? Like you've maybe explored, you know, different types of religions and different philosophical systems and that sort of thing. What about Jesus? Here's what I would say. Start with Jesus. And you're like, yeah, you're a Bible teacher. Of course you would say that. No, no, no. Jesus is the only one that you can falsify right away. The Bible puts its neck out on the chopping block. It makes claims that can be falsified, that can be disproven. And if you want to at least get that off your list, I mean, the world's most popular religion, Christianity, that would be the one to start with, and that's the one you could falsify right away. You could say, that's not even true. I already got that one off my list. Before you get into all of these esoteric different faith systems, stuff that you don't even know if it's true, you'd have no idea if it's true or not, start with Christianity and get your answer on that first. I think there's good reason to do this. If even there was a 1% chance that what Jesus claimed was true, I think it would be worth exploring. What else are you going to do? What, play FIFA at home? Watch TV? Oh, you're so busy. You can't explore this for like a couple hours? Read a book? Do some research into the most important question ever? Like that man, his son is going to die. Well, maybe there's only a 1% chance that Jesus could heal him. Well, I don't know, 1%, that's not very good. Why make the trek 20 miles, that's a long trip. And you have 20 miles back, that's 40 miles, that's a long way. Oh, you'd have to be completely asinine in your thinking if you wouldn't make that trip for the life of your son. Here we're talking about the life of your soul, where you're going to spend your eternity. Wouldn't you want to get that figured out? Are you open-minded enough to explore the evidence for this? It's there. In a little bit, I'm going to suggest that you pick up a small book. We actually give you a drink with it, too. It's our way of showing hospitality. Well-written, and it has persuasive evidence. I don't know if you're going to find it persuasive, but I do know that you're going to be impressed with the evidence that you see here. Read that book. Look into this for yourself and figure out what you believe about your own convictions.